The views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD presents Campus Voices, conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon.
Thank you, Jason. And joining us today on Campus Voices, we have two members of the College of Agricultural and Natural Resources, Professor Jeff Bueller from Wildlife Ecology, and one of his doctoral students, Solni Adelsteinsson. Was that close enough for that Icelandic name?
Yeah, I'll take it. It's better than most people do.
I think one of the things that is so cool about the College of Agricultural and Natural Resources is you've got lots of opportunities to do outreach kinds of things.
That's one of the things that we pride ourselves on in our department is a lot of the work that we do is field work. And so we get out in the field and we take our students out in the field, and that's a great place, a great learning environment to understand the natural world around us.
One of the things that you're notorious for is taking your undergraduates on a balloon ride.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I'm notorious for it, but...
You are now.
Yeah. It was an opportunity that presented itself that we took advantage of only because we had a few students in the class this semester, and I thought it would be a great opportunity for the class, which was landscape ecology, where we spend a lot of time looking at digital maps of land cover and digital maps of streets and roads and rivers and things, and that are representations of the real world, but are very different than the real world. And we spent a lot of time sitting behind our computers looking at these maps, and I thought, as I do in my other classes, I offer field trips for the lab, and I thought it'd be a great opportunity to get a good perspective of a real landscape by going up in a hot air balloon.
You've already started to answer one of the questions I was going to ask you, and that was, you know, the difference between working at the satellite image level and, you know, the hot air balloon level. I mean, part of it is you're more involved on the balloon level, aren't you?
Yeah, so it's a really great way to get a much more intimate perspective of the landscape and recognize that, you know, landscapes are very complex arenas that have lots of facets to them. And I actually have a quote from one of the students from the trip who captured exactly what I was hoping that they'd be able to experience while they were on the trip. And he said, "One of the things that I was struck by was the complexity of real landscapes when compared to their digital representations. It's easy to get into the habit of assuming that digital maps generated by remote sensing data are perfect representations of real landscapes. However, the truth is that real landscapes have near infinite levels of complexity at finer and finer scales. Limits of digital data, such as resolution, prevent remote sensing data from providing full, accurate pictures of the landscape." So I think that was a real nice way of explaining how, you know, when you're in this balloon, you see the forest and you don't just see sort of a two-dimensional image of a forest. You're in the forest. We were literally, I don't know, 10 feet above the forest in some cases, brushing against the treetops, and you can see all the structure of the forest. You can see the canopy, you see the mid-canopy, you see the understory, you see how all these things tie together in a perspective that we don't normally appreciate because most of the time we're just walking around on the ground looking up at the sky. And
yeah, they're walking around on the ground and you've got the students in the classroom showing them slides, but here they were right there.
Oh, yeah, we were eye to eye with, you know, birds in the tops of the trees. In fact, we were looking down on the birds as they were flying over the habitat, so it offered a really unique perspective.
Now, before we started this interview, you told me that you had an extra seat in that balloon ride, and Solni, you got to occupy it. Tell us from your point of view about that trip.
Right, yeah, it was great to get to go along. And for me, one of the things I work on involves, you know, in addition to disease ecology, involves migratory birds. So having that perspective of the literal bird's eye view of the landscape was really valuable. One of the things that really struck me was in these urbanized habitats, just how much green space there is from above that we don't really think about from below. And so how that factors into when birds are coming back to the area and figuring out where to, you know, select a forest patch to breed in. That's kind of what they're seeing. And we got to experience that.
Yeah, that was one of the things that really struck me. Part of this balloon ride, we started out in a very rural area, you know, the airport around Pottstown, and we slowly moved towards Royersford, and where there's a lot of urban development, and we saw this nice gradient going from these natural open habitats into suburbia and then into these urban areas. And in the suburban areas, you don't realize how, in certain places, closed the canopy is of trees above them. And so, you know, even from that perspective of floating over these residential areas, it looked like a closed canopy forest. And what's interesting is that a lot of these landscapes, these suburban forest areas, harbor a lot of migratory birds during migration. So maybe it fools them, too, into thinking that that's suitable habitat. Little do they know underneath is, you know, somebody's house in their yard. But from that perspective above these habitats, they look very similar to more natural habitats.
I think that's fascinating, but it's also, like you were saying, it's a complexity. I mean, all these different kinds of things that the students can see. I mean, the different ways people have built around what they've torn down, what they've left, and how they've landscaped around, you know, the forest.
Yeah, and one of the areas that we flew over was some state game lands, which I think had been an abandoned prison. So there are these empty shells of buildings, and then all around it was habitat that the state was managing for grass and birds. And so it was this interesting dynamic there that you had these, like you said, you have some places where we sort of abandoned them and let them come back up naturally. And so we got to see that from the balloon. So one of the inspirations for the hot air balloon ride was the example from Nader, who was this famous French photographer who in 1858 took the first aerial photograph from a hot air balloon in France and really sort of helped spark the whole field of landscape ecology. It was the first time, you know, anyone had seen what the Earth looks like from a different perspective, from off the ground. And so the trip was sort of an homage to Nader, who actually, we get the term Nader in remote sensing world is a term used to indicate looking directly below the sensor. So that's the Nader, is when you look directly below, and that was named after this French photographer.
What kinds of things do you hope that graduate students like Solny are going to come away from getting a degree in entomology and wildlife ecology?
Well, one of the things we hope they get take away is an appreciation for the natural world. Most of them come in with that drive and passion already. And one of the jobs that we have as faculty here is to also give them an appreciation of using science as a way of knowing and learning about the natural world and learning how to do good science, because this is sort of their preparation time. They're learning how to do science and how to do rigorous research so that when they go off on their own in their own careers, they're able to have those tools to help us build our knowledge.
One of the things that's interesting to me about the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources is it's not just, you know, trying to get Solny to get an academic understanding, but it's fitting this into the world in terms of policy, land use, and all those kinds of things.
It's hard to disentangle them a lot of the time, too. And so whenever we start working on one area, we immediately stumble into another. And so we do get that broad education because these different disciplines naturally kind of interact in our field.
Yeah, and a lot of the things that we study are really important for our own well-being. Some people might find it difficult to draw the relationships between why should we care about ticks and Lyme disease and the connections between those with the birds that are around us and in these environments. And ultimately, we're interested in conserving all of this wildlife because it helps sustain us. I mean, in many ways, we rely on the natural world and the services that it provides us in very direct and indirect ways. And I mean, one of the things that we rely on are bees for pollination. You know, you wouldn't have the food on your table if we didn't have insects to pollinate them. We wouldn't have clean water if we didn't have riparian forest buffers to help filter pollutants out and collect sediment. And so, you know, a lot of these things that we study may seem to some people as sort of esoteric sort of interests, but really they're important to society in a lot of different ways.
For example, Solny, I had a doctor's appointment today, and while I was waiting my turn, the gentleman in the waiting room with me started telling me about how Lyme disease has affected him. And that's one of the things you're interested in studying, is sort of how Lyme disease spreads, how do the ticks get it, and how does it spread throughout our environment?
Exactly, yeah. And also looking at how the health of forested ecosystems might affect that whole spread and the incidence of human contact with the disease.
Is Lyme disease now all throughout the United States, all throughout the North America?
It's been reported from almost every state, yeah. It's throughout North America. It's also in Europe and Asia as well. And it's now the most commonly reported vector-borne disease in North America.
Did it start here or did it start in Europe?
We don't know exactly. We've only actually known about the disease as, you know, since it's been described in the 70s, early 80s. But likely it's been around for thousands of years. They actually just discovered some genes of the bacterium that causes Lyme disease in the Iceman, which was 5,000 years old, which is now the earliest known report of this bacteria being around.
Wow.
So, yeah, clearly for quite some time.
So how do the ticks pick it up? How do they transmit it to us? And I guess, do other mammals get it, or are we the ones, the lucky ones?
Yeah, lots of other organisms can get it. Humans are sort of just an accident in the whole disease transmission cycle. Basically, the thing that makes it so interesting is that it's a multi-host system. So that just means that multiple different species can host the pathogen and transmit it to the ticks. So basically, the ticks typically start out their lives without being infected, but they serve as a vector. So the ticks have to feed on a host animal which already has the infection to acquire it, because they feed by taking blood from their host. Mm-hmm. So when they take that blood, they can get infected that way. And then if the tick survives to molt into the next life stage, then it comes out again looking for a blood meal. And at that point, if it got infected during the first blood meal, then it can transmit that infection.
When it goes to feed again.
Exactly. Exactly.
Little tiny Draculas.
Yeah, they are.
Now, one of the things I know your research has done is you're looking at plants. And that you know, to an English major like me or an English major like Sarah, the intern over there, I'm not sure that makes sense. Explain
sure.
that to us.
Yeah.
And like we're humanities majors. How does that work?
Well, that's one of the really exciting things about ecology is that we can look at all these interactions. So with the non-native plants we're looking at, we're particularly interested in multiflora rose because it's a really common invasive plant in the forests around here. And we think it may be impacting the disease transmission cycle in a couple of ways. It might be increasing the local abundance of ticks, and that could be because ticks require a high humidity and stable environment for survival. And the way that rose grows is really different from a lot of our native plants. So it might be creating this better microclimate in the forest for ticks to survive. But just having a lot more ticks won't increased disease transmission. So the other idea we're exploring is that rose may be creating really good habitat for the particular host species that are really good at transmitting the disease. So we're looking at white-footed mice, which are one of the main reservoirs for the Lyme disease pathogen, which just means that they're really good at hosting the pathogen and transmitting it to ticks. So if Rose is creating a better habitat for mice and for ticks, and then those two are interacting more in those environments, then we could see higher infection rates among the whole tick population and just more infected ticks on the landscape, which is a bad thing for people, obviously.
Now, I'm not familiar with multifloral rose. Where did it come from?
It actually came from East Asia. It was brought here mainly as a rootstock for ornamental roses. But then for a while, the Soil Conservation Corps was encouraging people to plant it as a living fence for cattle. And it would prevent soil erosion was the idea. But now it's done really well in this kind of temperate environment and taken over a lot of our forests. Some of the forests around here are more than 50% of the understory is covered with this plant.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, and it has thorns just like the roses that you're probably familiar with. So it's a pretty nasty invasive.
So that would affect all sorts of different animals, not just the animals that are good hosts for the Lyme disease.
Right. It has.
Well, it provides cover for mice. So it grows really dense, in real dense foliage, and of course it has the thorns, so a lot of small mammals use it as cover to protect them from predators.
Exactly, yeah.
But it seems to be kind of also serving as a nice humid, creating a nice humid environment for ticks. So kind of matching up the ticks with the mice and creating, sort of enhancing this problem.
One of the things I think I read somewhere that you're also looking at ticks, not just going around attached to different mammals to feed on the blood, but in the air? I didn't know that.
Right. Ticks feed on birds a lot, too.
Birds?
Yeah. Yeah, nobody's safe. a lot of folks don't think about it, but the ticks are pretty indiscriminate. They'll latch onto whatever comes by, which is why they grab onto people and try to feed on people,
so
too.
If it's got blood, ticks will bite.
Right, pretty much.
And so they don't fly themselves, but Mr. Red Robin is flying around with a tick or two attached.
Right, sometimes
yeah, in fact,
30
the
or
robin
40.
Is a pretty good reservoir for the Lyme disease.
Mm-hmm.
People just are used to just looking out there and saying, oh, isn't that pretty? Or, oh, you know, we could build something here. But the stories you're telling, just it's almost like everything is interconnected. I mean, there's a story here about how the germ gets into the bug, and then it gets into the robin, then it gets into a mouse, then it gets, you know, and so on and so forth. I mean, these are a lot of the kinds of things you guys look at in your department.
Yeah, and they also have connections to the landscape. And so one of the other aspects to this project is understanding how, you know, humans are interacting with the landscape, but how these animals that are living in our urban environments are interacting with us. And so we get exposed to these ticks when we, you know, play in our backyard and along the fence rows and in the woodlots where these ticks occur. And so there again, there's this interaction between people and the ticks, which is probably why this is one of the areas that has the highest per capita infection rates of Lyme in the country, you know, the whole mid-Atlantic region where we have very high human development, and yet we still have a lot of natural habitats in the landscape that harbor the ticks.
We'll keep talking about ticks and these little tiny things, but I mean, the standard thing that most people know about is that how all the building we're doing is affecting the larger animals as well. I mean, coyotes, wolves, bears, deer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, they're all being displaced or their habitats being moved.
Right, and that definitely has implications which come back to affect us too, the human populations, which a lot of folks don't think about. But there's an idea within the Lyme disease system that having more biodiversity will reduce the disease risk of the human population. So as we chop up our forests, we're leaving it so that there's really nothing that can live there but the mice or the really good disease reservoirs. But if there are more species able to inhabit a particular forest or an area close to human populations, there's a greater chance that more of those species are bad hosts for the disease. And so the overall infection rate among the ticks might be lower. And so by conserving biodiversity, we might actually be able to help our own human health.
We're talking with Professor Jeff Buehler from the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources, Department of Wildlife Ecology and Entomology, and one of his grad students, Solny Adelsteinson. Where are you doing this tick research?
Right around Newark area. So we're trapping a lot of ticks. So maybe we're, no, I don't think we're actually reducing the tick population, but we're working in a system that we, a research program really, that is known as the FRAME, which a lot of faculty members in our department are a part of. And it stands for Forest Fragments and Managed Ecosystems. And it's been a collaborative effort between UD, the U.S. Forest Service, and we've also had a lot of great help from communities around Newark, New York City Parks, and the county parks as well. So we're in, you know, Iron Hill, White Clay, some of the small forest patches, you know, along the the James F. Hall Trail. There's Phillips Park right there. So we're doing this stuff kind of right in everybody's backyard, trying to figure out what's going on and what's influencing disease transmission around here.
And also to get a better idea of the health of these urban forest fragments.
Right. And then we can ideally use that information to help develop plans for the future to reduce disease risk or improve the health of the forests around here.
And better understand how to conserve wildlife in urban landscapes.
Jeff, you recently sent up a balloon to look at not bird migrations, but
insect migration.
Wait a minute. These bugs move around too?
Oh, yeah. And in fact, we're learning a lot more about insect migration because of studies like this where we're catching these insects while they're in the act of migrating at night. And so the insects and birds primarily migrate at night. And the research that I do on bird migration, we use weather radar to detect birds in the air, and unfortunately, these weather radars detect everything else that's up in the air, including the insects.
And oh, really?
So, yeah. And so one of the major challenges that we have in trying to better understand bird migration using these radar observations is the fact that our data are contaminated with insects. And so we're also learning a lot about insect migration at the same time.
I'm fascinated by that. I thought the most insects lived, laid their eggs, lived a little bit longer, and died.
Well, they do, but a lot of them also travel far distances between generations. And what's interesting about insect migration is that it's often multi-generational. So most folks are familiar with sort of the story of the monarch butterflies. So they breed in Canada in the summer, and those populations that breed will start migrating in the fall. They'll migrate down to Mexico, and they overwinter in Mexico. And then that generation, they'll start to migrate back in the spring, but they will stop in, say, northern Mexico or Texas, and actually reproduce there. And then their offspring sort of carry on the migration back up to Canada. And so it takes several generations to sort of complete that migration cycle. And we're finding that that may be true of other species too, especially these nocturnally migrating insects. One of my colleagues, Jason Chapman, who just published a paper several years ago, He called the sort of the prevailing hypothesis the Pied Piper hypothesis, and that's this phenomenon where a lot of insects that overwinter along near the equator, you know, in sort of subtropical and tropical environments, they will migrate north to the temperate latitudes in the summer, and the thought was that that was sort of the lure of these flush of resources in the temperate latitudes in the summers sort of lured these insects to these areas where they would eventually just die, and that those populations that stayed in those more southerly latitudes were the populations that basically sustained the species. And so, and that they wouldn't return back in the fall. But what he's finding in similar studies where they're catching insects with a similar balloon system that we were deploying, in fact, they were sort of the inspiration for us to try this, and some of his radar work, they've documented that these insect populations are actually larger in the fall. So these insects that do migrate to these temperate latitudes in the summer, they'll reproduce, and their offspring, the population of their offspring is about four times higher than those of the ones that sort of colonize those areas in the summer. And those offspring will migrate south in the fall to those wintering locations.
So we're talking about two generations over the course of 1 year, or is it a multi-year and multi-generation process?
Well, in that system, it's a two-generation system. So there's one generation that migrates north, and then the next generation migrates south, and they just keep repeating it back and forth. But a lot of entomologists are sort of, I guess, coming to terms with this kind of system, and generally it's been overlooked. And it's easy to overlook a lot of these insect migrations because they're happening at night under the cover of darkness, and you know, we don't see them making these flights except when we use something like this balloon setup that we had, where we took this helium filled balloon to suspend basically a tow net up into the atmosphere to catch these insects while they're flying at night.
Do your ticks stay in one place solely, or do they migrate too?
Well, they migrate on birds, potentially.
So they migrate thanks to their hosts moving about.
Right, but fortunately, ticks don't have wings, so they're not going to get too far on their own.
No, but they do pretty well hitching a ride on birds.
They do.
I think there's been documented cases of tropical ticks showing up in Canada on the backs of warblers.
Wow.
Yeah. So because the warblers can cover a lot of ground in just a few days, and they can transport them thousands of kilometers in just a few days.
On these migration paths, do the birds feed on the insects that are migrating, or is it pretty much birds at one height and bugs at another? Excuse me, insects at another.
Yeah, so actually the insects do tend to fly lower than the birds, and as far as I know, the birds aren't foraging on the insects at night. Although what's interesting is there are also bats active. So bats are certainly foraging on these migrating insects. And the bats might actually be foraging on the birds as well. There's a species of bat, and I don't remember exactly where it occurs. They've documented this species of bat foraging on migrating birds at night.
It's really cool to have two guests from the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology here. What are you going to do when you get done with your PhD, Solny? Are you going to become a professor?
Hopefully, yeah, that's the plan right now. I'd like to be in research one way or another.
But it's such practical research. And it's just so cool. You guys get to play with so many fun things. And you get to do it outdoors. The world is your laboratory.
Yeah, that's what I love about it, definitely. And it's nice being at UD and having faculty with expertise in wildlife and entomology, and we have a really collaborative group, so it's a great place to be doing this kind of work.
Thank you very much, Jeff, and thank you very much, Solny.
Thanks very much for having me.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or policies of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archive copies of this and other episodes, visit our website. Using all lowercase letters, go to www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.